the Saturn system offers splendor beyond compare because of its rings and very diverse moons. You're listening to Western Worlds. Welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, whose buildings are as tall as Saturn's rings are thick, in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's quote comes from Carolyn Porco, the team leader for the imaging science subsystem on board the Cassini spacecraft, currently exploring Saturn and its satellites. Within the system is an incredible amount of variety, from the walnut-shaped Iapetus, made famous by Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey, to the Death Star that is Mimas, not to mention all the tiny moonlets that make up the rings, or the vast atmosphere of Saturn itself. First among equals, however, has always been Veiled Titan, covered in a haze, suspended in what is by far the thickest atmosphere of any moon. Attempts in the late 1970s and early 1980s by the Pioneer and Voyager spacecraft to glimpse its surface came up empty. As such, Cassini's instruments were specifically designed to pierce through the opacity. Some, like Dr. Porco's ISS, take advantages of slim, transparent windows in the haze near the visible part of the spectrum to obtain high-resolution images. Others, such as VIMS, led by Robert Brown of the Lunar and Planetary Lab, go deeper into the infrared to enable spectroscopy. But there is one instrument whose view is crystal clear, Cassini's Synthetic Aperture Radar, led by JPL's Charles Alacci. At such long wavelengths, the atmosphere and those suspended light-scattering particles offer little impediment. That is why SAR was the tool of choice for mapping the surface of Venus with Magellan and is often used on Earth, in part because of its ability to see through obscuring cloud. However, SAR's ability to look through clouds and haze are not its only assets. Instead, it complements other observation methods by providing invaluable information on surface roughness and other material properties. As well, since radio waves are much longer than visible light, radar energy penetrates the surface much more deeply, seeing through any thin surface coatings that may exist. As you will hear in Raymond Francis' interview with Cassini radar team member and JPL scientist Carl Mitchell, the SAR instrument aboard Cassini is also making great contributions to that other star of the Saturnian system, Enceladus. By giving us more information on the surface of that moon, we gain insights into the origins and the nature of its unique geysers. It's a fascinating subject, and I hope you enjoy the interview as much as I have, appropriately for the incredible wealth of information that has come from this one spacecraft. Tonight's music is The Bounty by Vangelis.
Dr. Mitchell, you're working on the Cassini mission, joint project of NASA, ESA, and the Italian Space Agency. Can you tell me, what is your involvement with Cassini?
I'm an affiliate on the Cassini radar team, so our main goal is to map the surface of Saturn's moon Titan to as high a degree of accuracy as possible and to learn as much about the surface as possible.
Okay, and maybe you can tell us a little bit, what is Cassini overall and what's that mission all about?
It's one of NASA's largest missions in many ways. It's a sequel to Voyager and Galileo. Galileo, its main goal is to map out in detail the Saturn system and its moons and its rings. As a follow-up to the preliminary tour done by earlier missions, so this is in much more detail and it just stays within the Saturn system.
Okay, and I suppose the radar instrument that you're working with is one of a whole suite of different sensors that you have.
Yes, it is. There are optical cameras, there are radio instruments, there are dust analyzers, that sort of thing. Quite a range of different instruments that all work together in order to give us a better understanding. The radar instrument itself, as I say, its primary goal is to look at the surface of Titan, the atmosphere of which is opaque to optical light, and so is of particular use in studying that surface.
Okay, the radar is able to penetrate that thick atmosphere.
Yes, it is, due to the very long wavelength. In effect, it passes through all of the gases and particles that optical light can't.
Okay, but recently at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, you presented work where you were using that radar to look at another body, Enceladus.
Yes, Enceladus has been interesting for a number of reasons. It's got a very young surface, and it's even though it's a very small moon, only 500 kilometers in diameter, so an order of magnitude smaller than Titan, it's very active. We've seen these incredibly high, bright, fast, eruptive plumes from the South Pole that suggest that the interior is molten and highly energetic, so the world has been of particular interest, and a lot of the later stages of Cassini have been refocused to look a little bit more at Enceladus.
What are these plumes like coming from the South Pole?
Well, they look a lot like geysers, although the process itself may be more akin to volcanic eruptions on Earth. On the icy satellites, your rock is basically ice, water ice mostly. The crust is water ice, and therefore what we consider magma is water ice there. And these plumes themselves, they're incredibly explosive. They've been much more visually similar in some ways to Io, because you can really see the plumes coming off the planet against the curvature of planet world, against the curvature of the moon when you look at it from optical instruments, at least.
Okay, now you said that the surface of Enceladus is very young.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean in terms of years?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer on that, mostly because the areas that are the youngest, which are the areas we've been looking at, are the ones without any significant craters on. And it's by looking at the accumulation of craters over time that we date surfaces. The flyby that we've done, and this is my first attempt to look at Enceladus, has shown no craters in that particular area. So we know it's probably less than, say, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of years old. I can't say exactly what the age would be, but that's as opposed to a 4.5 billion year old age of most of the bodies in the solar system.
Right. So that would be a very young age. And it's by looking for a count of craters on the surface that you're detecting that?
Yes. If you find no craters, you just know that it's very young. And if you find enough craters to get a statistical distribution, then you can attempt to approximate the age.
Okay.
And there are places on Enceladus where you have a fair few craters, but because of the active volcanic cryovolcanic process, we know that certain surfaces are so young you can't date it.
So you're saying that it also has a very bright surface?
Well, yes, to radar, and to some extent to optical, it's incredibly bright. The radar instrument sees the surface as having a radar backscatter, as we call it, of 6 dB. Now, that might not mean anything to those that don't study radar, but those of us that do study radar, that is unusually bright. It's also bright from every different direction. So to us, it's a bit like looking at the paint on road markings. You know how bright that is no matter where you are with the car headlights. It always seems bright from every angle or from above or from the side.
Yeah, and those are specifically designed to be bright.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what the radar instrument is seeing, and radar obviously works somewhat differently from optical systems, is just incredibly bright surface that normally on Earth, if you wanted something that bright, you'd have to design it deliberately.
That's interesting. And so is it the same everywhere? Is it bright all over the surface? Or?
It's variable. There's some bright surfaces and there's some extremely bright surfaces. And so when I refer to dark surfaces on Enceladus when I'm giving science talks, I'm definitely talking in a relative sense. The reason that they're bright is quite difficult to know at this stage. We know that it has to be something that is ordered. For instance, on Earth, a lot of spheres packed together would create a similar kind of reflection. A lot of corner reflectors, so cubes, could create a similar reflection. And these have to be larger than the wavelength of the radar. The radar itself is working at 2.2 centimeters, which compares with most optical instruments that are working down in the microns and nanometers scale.
Okay. So, but could we imagine that the surface of Enceladus is actually covered in some kind of, you know, spherical or cubic material?
Well, we can't really think of give any reason why the whole surface would be covered in anything spherical, for sure. Perhaps, and this is where we're going on at the moment with our wild speculations, and it's definitely a speculative stage, this is brand new data, perhaps the crust itself is formed from just particularly large crystals. If you heat small grained ice crystals, and all ice has some sort of grain size or some sort of crystal size, if you heat them in the right way or add energy to them in the right way, they can start to merge and form these larger crystals. Now, the idea of having 10 centimeter scale crystals that are ordered is unusual, but it's one of the few things that we've been able to come up with that could potentially explain realistically what is going on there.
Now, the other major feature which is visible on the surface of Enceladus are these large sort of linear features. They call them sulci. Do you know, what can you tell me about these and how we think they formed?
Well, there seems to be several sets of these features. The main ones that we're interested in at the moment are the ones that are nicknamed tiger stripes.
Okay.
So these are very large, kilometers or kilometer or two across, things that seem to be the source for the plumes that are erupting into space. Now, there's several of these, and we've seen the thermal source, the thermal signature associated with an active area. There are some more that go further out that we don't see as active, but have very similar spatial characteristics. And then there are other sets of grooves and ridges, that most of which are smaller. Different sorts of grooves and ridges seem to have different sizes and different spacing between them. But these are the ones that we have perhaps been most interested in, and we do see some of the inactive ones with the radar instrument. Unfortunately, in many ways to us, due to the very tightly constrained nature of the orbits that we're looking at, we weren't able to directly image with this radar pass any of the active ones. But crossing the inactive ones has certainly proved to be interesting on its own.
So now the instrument that Cassini carries is a radar, but it's a particular type called synthetic aperture radar.
Yes.
And it's very possible that the listeners aren't familiar with how that works. What can you tell me about SAR?
Well, synthetic aperture radar broadcasts a signal, pulses energy towards the planet, and then collects it. It works in many ways like sonar on submarines. It's the same sort of theory, and of course it's been used to detect airplanes, various applications around the world. By sending those pulses out, but then using the motion of the spacecraft, in effect what you can do is synthesize an aperture.
What does
that
mean?
So for those that are optical astronomers, you know that the larger your aperture, the easier it is to resolve features. So you have a wide aperture telescope, you get much better quality of images. And you can do the same whether it's a circular aperture or a very long aperture if you're not working with a circular system. And ground-based telescopes have often used multiple telescopes before in order to synthesize an aperture and get a much more refined ability to see the targets. And that's what the synthetic aperture radar method does. It sends data down to the planet. It sends it sideways. So it's at an incidence angle, looking down on the surface. And as it's passing over the landscape, and it's sending a fairly wide beam down to the surface, it's collecting that data moment after moment, and then building it all up to form this coherent image, using the extended aperture in order to create much higher resolution.
Okay, so knowing the speed at which the radio waves propagate and the speed of the spacecraft, you can computationally recombine it as if you had a larger antenna.
Exactly. And in doing so, we can get on Titan, at least, resolutions down to about 300 meters, which might not sound that much, but that's quite an achievement at such a long distance, given the limitations of the orbits and so on. With Enceladus, we were actually able to do better than that because we had to pass closer to the world in order to do that side looking. You can imagine if you've got a smaller target, you have to be closer to the surface in order to not look directly vertically down, which would give you distance, but it wouldn't necessarily give you the kind of image data you need.
Okay.
So we were able to get as good as about 50 meters resolution in certain circumstances on the surface.
How close to Enceladus did you make this pass?
It was about 500 kilometers, which is certainly closer than we go to Titan by a factor of a few. So it was quite a challenge, in fact. The spacecraft, when passing Enceladus, is going quite fast, more than 8 kilometers per second, which is really shifting it. Obviously, we're sending active pulses down, and we have to collect those on the way back. And so your ability to resolve the surface is largely limited by the speed that you're going at. And we had to send energy at the surface and be able to collect it. Now, normally we collect a very wide swath of data, but because of this speed, we had to narrow that swath just in order to resolve what the surface was. Otherwise, we wouldn't get enough data back to get any kind of signal.
Oh, so you even had to change the way that you normally use the radar?
Yes, it was a complete reinvention. The engineers on our team, Richard West in particular, basically had to redesign how the radar was used and come up with a completely new mode of operation, which was exciting. I I mean, we never really conceived that we would be doing this in the primary mission. It was always meant to be an instrument that looked at Titan. But after we'd looked at Titan for a while, we realized that, well, with this radar system, we haven't looked at any other icy satellite surfaces. And we certainly haven't looked at any icy satellite surfaces that have really good quality optical data. So after a fashion, as well as being interesting in its own sake, it was a ground truth for Titan, a way of learning about what we're looking at with radar relative to optical instruments where they don't have the problem of the atmosphere, and then converting it so that our understanding of Titan is improved.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, I guess, to use the same instrument in different places and see how it behaves.
Yes, exactly. And clearly we know a bit about the Earth. Radar has been used to study ice on Earth, and at times we found some very bright surfaces on Earth, so we're also trying to use that to inform our understanding of Enceladus and Titan. But Earth isn't an icy satellite, and it really does help to get a look at something that's perhaps more analogous.
And so the surface materials of Enceladus, are they very different from what you would be looking at on Titan?
To some extent, yes. I mean, we think the crusts are ice, certainly water ice, mostly. There may well be other impurities in there, but Titan has got a very active weather system. It's got an active organic chemistry going on in the atmosphere, and what we think has happened is nearly all the entire surface has a soil of organic materials, as opposed to Enceladus, where you do have erupting plumes, which also have some non-water ice components, but there's a much higher percentage of water ice in the surface. So it's certainly much more water ice rich, and as it appears to have, it's very bright, and therefore we think that the ice grain characteristics are different.
So then when you turned this Cassini radar on Enceladus, what did you find?
Well, on one level it showed much the same as we've seen with optical data. We can align the features very nicely, which is of course pleasing because it means at least we know we're looking at the right sort of surface and we can relate optical to radar. I mentioned the incredible brightness. We also see very clearly all of the tectonic faults. I mentioned the grooves and ridges and how the brightness of the surface seems to be very much related to those. So you get fairly bright patches of material that are bounded by broad faults. And even though the internal surface of that is faulted, the brightness is fairly consistent all over, taking away the shading effects, the topographic shading effect. It means, therefore, that we think the brightness, the bright patches on Enceladus are very much related to a tectonic resurfacing process. So the crust is torn apart. The previous existing surface is completely destroyed structurally. And so what we're looking at is a relatively freshly exposed surface with new tectonic features on it, but with different material reflective properties to the radar.
So then this implies that there would be periodic incidences where portions of the surface, patches of the surface of Enceladus are renewed and resurfaced with new ice.
Yes. This is most likely a fairly slow process by human standards. We don't think there's any strong evidence for the surface liquefying in any way, for instance. But it would be, by tectonic standards, a fairly rapid process of maybe subduction and extension and compression, and yet the whole surface getting ground up and reprocessed.
But, you know, processes like that would take a lot of energy to power and to move all of that ice and crust around.
Yeah, and the pattern of these patches seems to be related to those tiger stripes, the sources for these big eruptive plumes. And so we know, therefore, that there are high energy processes going on in this area of Enceladus, and it all ties in together. Understanding how it all fits in together is the big challenge that we have over the coming years as we bring in all of these different data sets and attempt to analyze them, interpret and model them until we can fit a big picture together.
Right. Are there any thoughts onto what the source of that tremendous energy would be?
Almost certainly orbital dynamical processes. You may have looked at Europa or Ganymede and Io in the Jupiter system. They're in orbital resonances, and as they proceed around Jupiter, the resonances with each other create energy, but transfer energy that builds up as heat under the surface. And in the case of Europa, it fractures the surface with this incredibly intricate network of ridges and grooves again. But on Io, it's stripped away all of the water ice. The energy levels are so high. And instead, you're left with something that's perhaps a little bit more like a rocky planet, but with vast amounts of sulfur and other volatiles. And that's eruptive in the traditional volcanic sense. So it's similar to that, but we don't really know for sure, or at least there are competing models out there, why this much energy is focused on Enceladus' south pole. That's a matter of some debate that hopefully is getting close to a resolution over the next few years.
And so is there something to be learned by combining that radar observation that you made with the visual? If you're seeing similar features, you get a lot of benefit from synthesis of modality.
To a large extent, the radar instrument is sensitive to different things. It penetrates the surface to a greater extent, and so it's the differences where the really juicy information is. The radar working at 2.2 centimeters wavelength will often be seeing things that are maybe tens of centimeters down below the surface in the extreme. And so if you've got a light dusting of all of this eruptive plume form material out over the entire surface, the radar may see through that in places where the optical instruments don't. And so that's certainly complementary. We also have sensitivity to different kinds of material properties. Radar is sensitive very much to the dielectric constant of materials, and dielectric constant varies from material to material. It's also structurally sensitive in ways that optical isn't. And so by combining the two, hopefully we add great value to the analysis. It's always worth having more data at different wavelengths, but radar's way out there, way beyond anything else that's been used.
What's that dielectric constant when you're talking about materials?
It's basically an electrical property of the surface. It's a lot like the capacitance in electrical circuits. But what it means is that when you actively send radar data to the surface, it's how that surface responds directly to that radar.
Okay. And so, here you have an instrument that's able to tell things about the surface that just a simple camera wouldn't be able to do.
Exactly. All of these data types are complementary. Otherwise, we just send one camera there and it would tell us everything. But instead, we have ultraviolet, we have optical, we have infrared, and we have radar.
Okay. So this is the first ever time that you'd used synthetic aperture radar to look at an icy surface. This was just last November?
October.
Yes. And so having this new capability, this technique that you've now demonstrated, is this something that you think we'll be able to do again in the future?
I'm afraid I don't think so. Obviously, if the opportunity arises, we'll try. And decades down the line, we certainly will. But with the Cassini spacecraft, it's got a limited life expectancy. We expect it to plunge into Saturn in 2017 or so. And the limited flybys of Enceladus, we all have specific aims for specific instrument teams, goals that have been set. And at the moment, all of those goals have been set. The instrument teams have been selected. All the plans are made. And so in order for radar to get another opportunity, we'd have to displace one of the other teams, which we really don't want to do.
Okay. Yeah, there's obviously a lot of things to look at in the Saturn system. So.
Oh, yes. It's a fascinating place.
So you talk about the end of life of Cassini coming up.
Yes.
This is some 5 years out.
Yes.
And you talk about plunging the spacecraft into Saturn. Why is that the end of life scenario?
Well, the reality is that we're limited by the amount of fuel we have on board. In theory, we could extend Cassini out for decades, but you're in a high radiation environment. Eventually, the instruments will die. And if you just keep going and going and going and hardly ever spending any fuel, you wouldn't get any of these nice close flybys to the moons. And so you'd be very limited in what you can do. So it's been a trade-off between trying to extend the life as far as possible and trying to get the best data that's available. And during the final few months, we'll have this great opportunity to spiral into to Saturn and collect really close-range data, the best ever.
Oh, okay. So you'll be able to finally look close up at the planet instead of only its moons.
Yes. And during that time, obviously, there will be this descent phase through the system where you do much smaller and smaller orbits. So we'll be flying past Titan several times on the way down in order to get into just the right orbit for the final plunge. But I think 2015 or 2016, I can't remember off the top of my head, maybe our last opportunity to see Enceladus, I'm fairly sure it's 2015.
Okay.
And yeah, it's going to be an exciting ride for the last few years as well. We want to keep up the levels of activity throughout.
Sounds like an interesting and perhaps fitting exit dance for this long ballet out in the Saturn system.
Yeah, very much so. It should be a dramatic time for us.
Excellent. Well, thank you for speaking to us, and maybe we'll catch up with you again with new results in the future.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
Interview with Dr. Mitchell from JPL about this exciting new observation they took using the Cassini SAR to look at Enceladus. Certainly they found some things that they weren't expecting.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting to hear about tectonics on a moon of Saturn that we know in pretty good detail. If I ever start a band, I definitely want Cryovolcanoes to be the name of that band.
Cryovolcanism is an interesting idea that we think about as rock and crust and mantle. Yeah, happening at really cold temperatures, so with different materials.
Another interesting thing, too, is that this is a very small moon, and many scientists didn't think that such small objects could have these kind of activities, so it's interesting in that sense, too.
You can imagine this sort of thing happening with these moons if there's some tidal forcing that's moon on every orbit. I'm not sure if they fully understand the source of it for Enceladus, though.
No, he did mention that yeah. might be the cause, but I don't think there's been
any... The tidal is part of it, probably some... radioactive heating in the core.
Well, that's another problem, is that the radioactive heating should be long dissipated in a body as small as Enceladus. And the tidal forces, at least if we have its orbit correct, and it has been in that orbit for the last 4 billion years, as we sort of suspect, then it shouldn't be that squeezed as to make it as warm as it seems to be to generate the energy for the cryovolcanism.
How far away is it from Saturn in comparison to, say, Io?
I don't know how it compares to Jupiter, but it's basically the source of particles for one of the outermost rings.
Yeah, it's just
E-ring.
Inside the E-ring.
Yeah.
Might be the source of particles in the E-ring.
Yeah.
That could cause some of the activity, but probably not a good deal under the surface.
Yeah, I mean, it needs to be a replenishing activity as well, mm-hmm. right? You know, I think I read somewhere that if it was just doing this, it would only last for, say, a few million years or 100 million years or something like that. The fact that this E-ring is there and stable, then this must be continuous.
And it's interesting. It seems that this kind of activity is regional. On Enceladus. It's not a global phenomenon. It's near the South Pole and just in that one area.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that happening on that moon in that one place?
I guess everything's just leaking out the bottom.
Yeah, right. The bottom. That's a good convention.
But, I mean, you think about Earth, for example. I mean, there are places where the crust is thinner than others, so there's no reason to think that would happen.
You have the mantle plume in Hawaii, which is
a very active Pacific Rim.
Sort of planetary scale, at the scale of the body, that lends itself to having a single point of failure, if you will.
Well, if you think of Mars, that effectively is how volcanism worked on Mars, as you had the Tharsis region, which absorbed almost all of energy for volcanism, into these giant volcanoes. And there was not all that much activity anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It's just this one massive magma plume, like Hawaii on mega steroids, which kept bubbling up in this one place over a billion or so years.
So Mars had a jet engine?
Yes, actually, because it is so high, Olympus Mons, some of the ejecta would be tossed out into orbit. You might get a minuscule amount of thrust.
Yeah.
Minuscule.
And a ring.
With pictures of Enceladus, you can see the plumes well over the curve of the mm-hmm. planet, of the moon, and it does make me wonder, does some of that escape?
Well, if it's feeding the E-ring, yeah.
Yeah.
But that could also be due to impacts on the surface.
You figure the ring is made from ejecta.
I don't know.
Okay,
it could be part of it.
I don't know.
It could be a little bit of both.
Yeah, I've seen that it could be attributed to both as well.
On Io, which also has these massive globe-spanning, lovely umbrella plumes, that's attributed to huge particle flux in the region of Io, the Io Flux Torus, which is a famous formation where the gases coming off Io actually couple with Jupiter's magnetic field and get funneled in towards Jupiter's poles, which lead to massive aurora and a radio signal, which was actually first detected by Tesla way back in 1900-something. He thought he was contacting aliens. It just turned out to be Jupiter.
Well, he might have done that, too.
Well, yeah, it's Tesla.
There's all kinds of things he might have done.
And then Edison stole the credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of electrical wonders, I mean, synthetic aperture radar, we're never going to get something of this kind of resolution without a giant antenna or the kind of advanced computational techniques that they're using to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's 50-meter resolution, right?
I don't know if it was that good. I thought it was 300, yeah.
Okay.
Or was that on, that might have been on Titan, and then he said they had better on Enceladus, but he didn't really say a number.
Yeah, but in any case... But yeah, and of course the Cassini radar was not planned to do this kind of observation, right? This is for looking at Titan through the clouds.
Yeah, it's really cool. They managed to retask it and get such good information out of something that wasn't even intended as a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they had to change the way that they operate the radar, the way that they process the data, but this is what we get. You know, SAR is a technique that has proven its use throughout the solar system. It's good to see that yet another exciting case, not just to get topography, but also to get intensity of reflection. It's cool. We're finding some things out about this body that we wouldn't have known.
The amount of reflection is pretty incredible too. And I guess, again, said that they're not sure why the albedo is so high.
Yeah, the brightest in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty incredible.
Especially in radar, which you do expect icy bodies to be somewhat reflective to radar, but not mirror smooth, shiny, reflective to radar.
It suggests that there's still a lot to know about how the body is resurfacing itself. Mm-hmm. And exactly what is going on down there at the fine scale.
I think this is an open problem in the material science or the mineralogy, because when we think of minerals, you know, we're thinking of silicates and carbonates. We're not thinking of ammonia or methanates. We don't even have a nomenclature for this yet. And so the crystal structures that this could be forming, I think that's sort of out there, which really we haven't brought in the geologists on this. It's been an astronomical sort of, okay, so there's cryomaterials, great. But there hasn't been a great deal of work on that end to tell us exactly, so you have this such and such a radar reflectance with such and such a dielectric constant. That means you have cis crystallized, you know, so on and so on. Which we can do on the terrestrial planets because we know terrestrial rocks so, so well.
Yeah, geologists and astronomers really confront different problems. One group gets to go and actually dig into the thing they're studying. We have 50 or 300 meter scale pictures.
Yeah, although, I mean, there has been some work done on that. We've been doing radar things for Mercury, for example, for some time, and there's areas that they think maybe they're finding a signal that suggests ice there.
Well, again, ice is easy.
Yeah.
We know ice. Like, these are easy terrestrial analogs, with all the terrestrial rocks and ice. But when you get to things that only exist at minus 200, there's not been a lot of synthesis work to attempt to replicate that.
Yeah, and of course, those are temperatures that, for those of us who grew up on the Earth, are kind of exotic.
Yeah.
You know, of
course, they stay that way.
Yeah, well, if we're going in the other direction, if anything, but most of the universe is even colder than that, so we better get used to it.
I liked how he mentioned, though, that, you know, doing these radar techniques on various bodies in the solar system, they're getting more and more data points so that they can do analog studies. So even though we might not get as good of data for Enceladus as we do for Mars or Mercury or whatever, we can still kind of make those connections.
You can do synthetic aperture radar at a span of different wavelengths. There's multidimensional space that still is to be explored in all of the different ways that you understand SAR data. They do what they call C-band SAR for Earth, because you can look at features that are of an interesting scale for here, from low Earth orbit, and you can do everything from tracking ships to estimating crop yields with spacecraft like RadarSat. But when we do these planetary missions, we're constrained with power, and we're looking at different materials, so they're, again, choosing different wavelengths to try and get through atmospheres of Venus or Titan. And there's a whole lot of empty regions there of wavelength and material that is being sensed and such that we have yet to explore.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a lot of potential for this technique yet.
Yeah, we just need more time and more flybys.
Well, and again, we simply haven't put the equipment out there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a dedicated SAR on Cassini. We just have the Cassini radar, which was adapted to this. And if it had been launched now, it probably would have a much more advanced, possibly multi-band equipment.
Well, I think all we're learning from Cassini is how much we don't know and that there's so much left to learn. And hopefully that does drive the next generation of spacecraft. I got to imagine that that's now one of the most interesting places in the solar system. It's really exciting that we have a spacecraft patrolling around Saturn right now, learning about all its moons. Hopefully we will get more dedicated things going out there.
That's our show for this week. Western World is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Tyler August, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Zengi Hu, Michelle Parsons, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week right here on astronomy.fm.